Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Fridays are all about food, and we're kicking off our new show with some fantastic folks who know a thing or two about food. They're here today to talk to trends for the coming year, what's hot, literally and figuratively, in 2014. Will kale still be the it veggie? I didn't even know it was the it veggie. Will all our meats be brined? Where in our region can we find the best eats? Steve Barnes is a columnist and blogger for the Times Union. He's author of the widely read Table Hopping blog and column, one of the foremost experts on food and dining in our region. The chances are very high that the latest restaurant review you read was his. Dale Miller is a renowned chef here in the Capital Region, one of 68 certified master chefs in the entire U.S. He started his own baking and catering business at the age of 12 and has been going ever since. He's been at the helm of some of the region's most recognized restaurants, including Jack's Oyster House, Sperry's Restaurant, and, of course, Dale Miller, The Art of Dining. Steve, Dale, nice to have you guys here.
Glad to be here.
Great to be here.
This is the first Food Friday, so let's endeavor not to screw it up.
Okay, we'll do our best.
So far, so good.
Now, you know, if you must, Steve, talk about eating goat's heads and stuff, I suggest we wait till the end of the show. We'll offend people.
Well, all right. I'd give them something to look forward to.
Exactly. Well, gentlemen, the overarching topic, at least until we get phone calls, and I should say that we love your phone calls here. It's 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can comment at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website. It's wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But feel free to give us a call, 1-800-348-2551. So the overarching topic as we start the show is trends for the coming year, and I must say I'm a bit out of the loop, many decades out of the loop. What do you guys see in your crystal balls?
Why don't you start, Dale?
Well, I think locavore cuisine and local sourcing of meats and seafoods and vegetables.
Why is that important?
Well, because it's getting away from the processed and the big box, big box stores where the food vendors and things like that, and you're supporting the local farmers and your local community. Helps with environmental sustainability, and
But can you taste it? In other words, all of those things are valid and good reasons mm-hmm. to buy local, and if you're running a restaurant using local sourced material, but can you taste the difference?
You tell me, Ray. You ever had a summer tomato right out of a garden, right out of your neighbor's garden?
Right out of our garden.
That you bring out and then you slice and you either just a little bit of salt or you put it on a salad.
Yeah.
Now you go down the street to the supermarket right today, you grab a tomato, slice it open. What's the difference between the two?
All right. Okay. Fair enough.
You know, it's huge. And then, so if you map that onto a larger local scale, if you're going to have a cow that's raised in a giant feedlot in the Midwest, grown extremely rapidly on food that you're not exactly sure what's in it, and then maybe pumped full of antibiotics, versus a cow or a sheep that's grown on a Washington County farm that is free to amble around, eat grass, and is slaughtered humanely, and then brought to you and sold to you directly by the farmer. Just in principle, which one would you want? And then you can tell by taste.
Okay, in principle. But can you tell by taste
that an
animal is free range? I see that a lot.
Absolutely you can, because it goes into... Now, one of the things here is that Americans have been so conditioned by American Midwestern feedlot beef that's raised on grain that mm-hmm. when they taste grass... fed beef, it's a little different because it is leaner. It might be a little gamier. But once you learn the difference, once you make the distinction, you really understand that what you're eating is a better food product, not only for you, but for the environment.
Is that a challenge then to change the cooking style from something that is grass-fed from grain-fed?
Well, you have to adjust your cooking styles to, different variables with food products, because nothing is going to come in exactly the same twice. I mean, mm-hmm. you're going to have strawberries that are riper, obviously, in June than they are in January. So you have to take all of that into account. I was fortunate as a kid growing up in a farming family, so I got to taste what a freshly slaughtered pig tasted like, and the utilization of all the products of taking the head, and making head cheese, and pickling the knuckles, and the lamb's tongue and things like that. And it really gave me a great basis for what I do today. Also, my father was a huge woodsman. We had a constant supply of venison and pheasant and duck and goose. My mother was an incredible cook. She loved to try to experiment with different flavors and so on. But she, you know, the simplest things, like taking a black iron skillet and just seasoning a very thinly cut venison steak with a little bit of salt and pepper, and she would save the bacon fat and put that in the skillet and just sear it quickly. It's unbelievable.
Well, you really can't go wrong with bacon fat, but it's not all that popular nowadays.
Well, like anything else, as long as it is used in moderation.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, one of the things that I do think, getting back to the idea of trends, is that portion size will continue to be something that will matter increasingly to customers. You know, there is, it's an American mentality, but it definitely seems to be an upstate mentality that if you're not walking out with a doggy bag that's good for at least two more meals, you feel like you've been ripped off. And one of the things that I've campaigned against this, and I know restaurateurs would prefer it, is to be able to offer smaller portions at more reasonable prices. Mm. Because, come on, most restaurant food is not going to taste as good heated up the next day. So, you know, why not have, and frankly, you know, the government recommends that the serving size for a piece of protein, beef or chicken, is about 4 ounces, or the size of a playing card.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got steakhouses out there serving 16, 20 ounces of steak. A couple of places, when I checked, did a story on chicken parmesan, were serving 12, 14, 16 ounces of chicken parm.
Yeah.
And there's really no need to have a portion that large. People will talk about value, but how about something that's more healthful from better sources, that's more modestly portioned? And I definitely think will be a trend.
That's Steve Barnes. He's one of our guests here on the first ever Food Friday Vox Pop. Also, Dale Miller, a certified master chef. We would love your calls. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Loosely talking about trends for 2014, but anything you want to talk about, we would love that. Are you on board with what Steve talked about as far as reducing portion size,
Absolutely,
Dale?
Absolutely. For me personally, getting a huge slab of meat or a 16-ounce chicken parm is a definite turnoff for me.
A nice big steak once in a while, isn't that nice?
Well, not to an extreme, though. I'm not talking about 42-ounce steak.
No.
Or something like that, so.
No, but think about it. Think about it this way. The law of diminishing returns applies to food as well. If you've got a 16-ounce steak, it's never going to taste as good as those first 4 bites. So why not have 4 bites of steak and then move on to something else that's another 4 bites? Because by the time you get to your 14th bite, it doesn't taste anywhere near as good, and you're still eating just because there's something in front of you. And darn it, I paid $28.95 for that steak, so I'm going to be uncomfortable when I leave.
Well, I personally would need more than 4 bites.
Right, but why not switch to something else with another fabulous 4 bites? So start with 4 bites of fish, and then 4 bites of chicken, and then 4 bites of vegetable, and then you get to your 4 bites of steak, and every single one of those bites is amazing. They don't deteriorate in taste because you've got a huge portion.
Dale?
Right. That's that's what happens with your taste buds. They kind of get dulled over the course of eating one thing. And so, and as Steve said, it's just doing smaller portions and experiencing unique and varied flavors throughout the course of your meal.
Let's go to the phones at 800-348-2551 on this inaugural Food Friday. We go to Ray in Shutesbury. You're on.
Hi. I got a question for you about gluten, which really I'm not familiar with because I don't have a problem with it. But we went out with a couple last week at a restaurant in Western Mass here where we live, and the poor guy had a lot of trouble trying to find anything on the menu that was gluten-free. And I notice it, you know, it just in conversation with other people, it seems like more and more people have problems with that. Do you notice that yourself as restaurateurs, that's becoming an issue with the menu?
Absolutely. The gluten-free trend has become huge. We had actually a specific gluten-free menu for those people at the last two restaurants that I was at. They're saying within 5 years it's going to be one of the top three trends in dining and cooking.
Now, is that because of capitalism and finding a market and going for it, or is that because more people are having intolerance to gluten?
More people are having intolerance
Why,
to gluten because of the fact that...
Yeah, me too, I wonder.
Well, because the diet has become more bread and starch driven as opposed to vegetables and fruits, and the fruits and vegetables have enzymes which help break down the gluten. So that is one of the major reasons for that.
And there's a difference, too. Some people have gluten sensitivity. Some have serious aversions to it. Some have actual celiac disease, which can be very serious.
Yep.
But as more people become aware, they find that if they adjust their diet, they feel better. They may not, it may not sicken them, it may not physically harm them. They just feel better if they eat gluten-free. And any restaurateur who's worth his menu is going to be able to adapt to gluten-free because they know that any sort of allergens or other things are out there. And so a better restaurant will be able to adapt.
Ray, thanks for the call so much. Now, how have you adapted, Dale? I mean, what challenges does that present to some of the traditional dishes that you would make?
Well, finding, you know, it's not really a huge challenge because driving flavors by proper cooking methods and finding alternative seasonings for, you know, using fresh herbs and things like that help create flavor. You know, there are challenges because somebody who has definitely a celiac disease, you can't even share the same fryer with if you've fried a breaded item into a fryer, you can't do a gluten-free item in the same fryer because they'll have a reaction to it. But developing recipes, baking is very difficult with gluten, gluten-free items. It's very difficult to bake with without gluten.
Mm-hmm.
But we did develop a popover at Sperry's that was gluten-free that people just said was unbelievable.
Tasty.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Dale Miller. Steve Barnes, also our guest on this first-ever Vox Pop Food Friday. We will take a break and back with your calls at 800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from Berkshire Co-op Market Great Barrington. Offering organic and local groceries, working to build a healthy and sustainable community, berkshire.coop. Barry Price Architecture, since 1996, specializing in buildings that integrate modernism and sustainability with regional materials and aesthetics, barrypricearchitecture.com. And Buttermilk Falls Inn, Milton, a 75-acre Hudson Riverfront resort with lodging, a farm-to-table restaurant, and spa, buttermilkfallsinn.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number, the first ever Food Friday, and Steve Barnes here from the Times Union, Dale Miller, renowned chef, a certified master chef. How does one become a certified master chef, Dale?
Well, it's actually a 10-day test that's given. It's sanctioned by the American Culinary Federation.
Do you hear that? That's a 10-day test. This is not 4 hours. This is a 10-day test.
Yeah. And if you know somebody, you get to eat the test items.
those are the judges, but they're also really esteemed chefs. So 10 days. Yep. That's why there's only 68 of them.
Yep.
And there really aren't that many in the whole wide world, right?
That's correct.
68 in America.
68 in America. Every country has kind of their own master chef program.
Yeah.
So it varies from country to country. The United States has one of the most stringent tests available for a master chef.
So now do you get the call from somebody, say, in Peoria, hey, I got a real problem here. Can you fly out and help me out?
I do have people that email me or call me and ask me my advice and questions about, you know, different items. Or
what's your hourly? No, you don't have to. All right, let's go back to the phones.
I'm not smart enough to charge, so.
Oh, wow. We got to get you an agent. All right, let's go to Bill in Skodak. So. Bill, you're on.
All right, how you doing? Guys?
Good.
My question, what do restaurants do? I hear quite often many restaurants saying that they always or try to always use locally grown produce. What do they do, and what does the average person do in the winter months in our area when obviously, fresh produce isn't available locally?
Well,
short of canning and pickling and
right.
such.
maybe a way to think about it, Bill, would be to adjust some of your expectations, because you know I have a CSA, community supported agriculture share, that I do during the growing season. But one of the things they offer in the winter is monthly deliveries of root vegetables. So I've got potatoes and cabbage and carrots and things that are, and plenty of butternut squash, things that you can get. And also we have, if you go to farmers markets, there are people who are growing hydroponically. They're growing lettuces. So, you know, maybe it is, if you're committed to local, you just don't. There are some restaurants who won't offer tomatoes in February. Mm. They say, if I can't get it. So maybe it's adjusting what's on your menu to what's available. And that part of the whole fresh local seasonal ethos, and Dale is someone who for years would change his menu seasonally, would adapt. You know, you'd say, what's available, and then I can change my recipes and change my... Because, frankly, in the summer, people don't want to be eating beef stew. Today, perfect day for beef stew.
Yeah.
And what's in beef stew? Root vegetables, beef.
Hmm. All right, Bill, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Steve, you mentioned CSA. Now, that's community-supported agriculture. You have a share. What does that mean?
What that means is there's a farm that projects to grow X amount of produce throughout the season, and they divide that up among however members you get, and you pay a set fee in advance that allows the farm to plant and hire labor and everything. So up front, you pay whatever the fee is. It might be $150 if you do half a share, might be $300 for the whole share, and then you get 20, 25 weeks of fresh vegetables. Every week you go to a pickup spot and you come back with vegetables. And sometimes that means you have an awful lot of green peppers. And then the next week you might say, oh, I have tatsoi again. But the adaptation is, it's a way of, again, living the way closer to the way people did in the past. You eat what's fresh and local. And I'm never one to complain about too many tomatoes in August.
Well, I mean, that's a great way to support all of the farmers who are not big industrial farmers nowadays. So that seems like a nice thing to do. Back to the phones we go on this Food Friday. Dale Miller is our guest. Steve Barnes is our guest. And Bill in Glens Falls, you're on.
Hey, guys. How are we doing?
Very well.
Doing great.
I'm interested, kind of a two-part question. Steve, I'm wondering how your blog, which you know I'm a big fan of, has evolved over the last 5 or 6 years. And Dale, do chefs pay attention to what they read on internet blogs?
Well, I'll start. The way table hopping started very small. In fact, it took me a year and a half to convince the Times Union that there was enough news out there in the restaurant business to justify a blog. They said, what will you put in there? Because previously our restaurant news had been one column in the food section every week that was 4 or 5 items. Mm. They said, how are you going to fill a blog that would require 5, 10, 15 items a day, every day? And I said, it's out there. I know it's busy. And since then, table hopping has grown to about 400,000 readers a month. I've had more than 150,000 comments, and I have approved every single one of those and rejected a whole bunch more. And it is an all-consuming part of my life. I do publish a variety of other things in print and elsewhere in the Times Union, but the restaurant industry is really thriving. I do an end-of-the-year count, and just recently we totaled, with readers' help, I totaled 90 restaurant openings and 60 closings. So that's almost every single day, every other day on average during the year, we get an opening or a closing. And so it's a busy industry. People tend to change. You know, a chef, Dale had some, he was, you know, in one place for 10 years, another place for 10 years. That's fairly unusual. Chefs, it's like servers, it tends to be a business where people move around. And so there's a lot to cover. And it's a really busy beat to cover. And people, dining is a spectator sport. Even if somebody didn't want to go out, they want to hear about your meal. Even more, I covered the arts for years, and people want to talk much more about a restaurant meal, even more so than a concert. And so whether or not chefs actually read the blogs, I know they comment on the blogs, but let's go directly to one and see what he says.
Well, Steve, I just want to say you do an amazing job on the blog, first of all.
Thank you.
And it's great to help promote the tremendous talent that we have in this area. We have so many incredible chefs in this area, and I don't think a lot of people realize that. I think, yes, we do pay attention to things like if there's a new restaurant opening and you've reviewed it or you've had a dish there and what your thoughts and so on are on it and your opinion is on that restaurant. I think some of the things that we try not to pay attention to is coming from the bloggers themselves, where they're not apprised of what's happened, for a reason of why you left the restaurant or whatever. So, and they'll just make some kind of generalized comment.
Mm-hmm.
The comments
on the blogs?
Yes, Dale is trying to say that sometimes people are ignorant and mean.
Mm-hmm.
And as someone involved in the media, right, you know when the anonymity of the internet brings out a culture of sadism in some subset.
You're absolutely right.
Some subset of commenters. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when because chefs and restaurateurs, particularly when there is close attention to them and they're at a level of Dale, they are semi-celebrities. They are local celebrities in the food world. And so they become public figures. And,
yeah.
And we know what happens to people, whether it's, you know, Paris Hilton or the Kardashians, forgive me for mentioning you in the same sentence.
Yeah. There's a comparison I didn't see coming, but
but it still brings out when there is, as a friend of mine in the business likes to say, who's in a prominent position, he says, you know, tall trees get all the wind. So if you're prominent, if you're famous, people are going to say terrible things about you, and only a portion of them are going to be true.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it very much. Do you read your own notices? I mean, in other words, if you get something that's maybe not the best, you know, notice you've ever had, do you make changes?
I do. Absolutely. And because I always like to see a fresh pair of eyes looking at something, and I really will analyze whatever was taken, you know, or said about a certain item or whatever, and take that into consideration. Absolutely.
And I think that's important. He said, take it into consideration, because I often get calls from upset owners or chefs or bartenders who say, oh, that was what somebody said was really mean. And my answer is, if they're right, if the criticism is valid, then make a change. If it's not, ignore them.
Yeah.
Because you actually know better than they do. You're the professional.
You know, you cover the arts as well. Do you find the mentality of the artistic sensibility of a chef, let's say, somewhat akin to a theater that you might review or an actor?
It's not somewhat akin. It's absolutely akin.
Really?
Chefs are the better chefs. I'm not talking about somebody who is, you know, working in a boil-in-a-bag restaurant with, you know, pre-portioned things. I'm talking a true chef, somebody who you can say, Here's a walk-in cooler. There's a heat source. Here are 10 plates. You have 2 hours. Feed me. That sort of chef is every bit a Picasso, a Rembrandt, a Marlon Brando, Miles Davis.
You know, I asked a chef. I had a chef on, Dale, a month or two ago, and I asked the question, how much of being a chef is science and how much is art? And I'll ask you the same question.
A tremendous amount of it is art, and the scientific part of it comes more with baking, because there's a chemical reaction with the ingredients that you use. I think cooking foods, cooking in a restaurant and cooking foods is more, for me, comes from the heart and is a more creative type of element.
You started early, age 12. Did you always know you had it?
Well, I still don't think I have it.
Oh, come on. I mean, a great musician knows that they have it early on.
It was just something that I really love to do, and I'm very fortunate to be able to be working in a profession that is something I love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably why I've been successful at it, because I know people that have jobs that they hate, and they're miserable every day, so...
That's true. Dale Miller is our guest. Steve Barnes is our guest. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Here's one that came over via WAMC.org. So what does the region, this is from J.S. Clark. So what does the region need to do to take the next step up to being a more sophisticated foodie, farm-to-table marketplace? What are we already doing right? Where can we improve? And thanks for Food Friday, Vox Pop, and thank you for listening, J.S. Clark. All right, gentlemen.
Well, can we extend this until 4 o'clock?
We may not, sir. Brian Shields will be quite upset.
That's really an extraordinary question. A huge part of this has become making those improvements is diner education, education of the customers. And one of those things that this started really with the Food Network, making people much more aware about chefs. And sure, you can have problems with chefs becoming rock stars. And so somebody like Guy Fieri, who's not a consummate artist as a chef, you know, being a multimillionaire. But the awareness of food, the awareness of trends, the awareness of sourcing of ingredients, that is all really important. And having food bloggers out there, having food coverage out there increase, we work in some sort of partnership with the industry, you know, where we sometimes serve different purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're doing something new, when they're doing something interesting, we're there to be able to spotlight it and say, hey, here's something that's out there. And so it is a matter of customer education. It's putting things like the name of the farm or the farmer on the menu. It's mentioning why you're using a particular ingredient. It's having servers that are well-versed in the ingredients to be able to talk to customers about it and make them say, you know what, this is a better product.
Dale, you concur?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I concur. It's it's an educational process, and compared to 30 years ago, 35 years ago, when you'd go out to a restaurant and a filet mignon and a shrimp cocktail was a high end meal.
Yeah.
It's really come full circle, and that really kind of started with the United States winning the World Olympics in cooking back in 1976.
Yeah, well, I had no idea that I'd be under such pressure when I went to a restaurant. Now I have performance anxiety. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Roger in Gloversville, you're on, bud.
Where in the Capital District can I find a shrimp parmesan on the menu? I've gone into a variety of restaurants. I've asked if they have it. They said no, and they've come back and said the chef says he could make it up, but it's never quite right.
Oh, boy.
Well, the first thing, I don't know any place off the top of my head, but as soon as I get out of here, what I'll do is I will go and put that question on my table hopping blog,
yeah.
And if it's out there, readers will know where it is. Right. It is something I've not regularly seen. I would think some of your more classic Italian restaurants, maybe like Sam's in Albany, Villa Italia in Albany, some of the great Schenectady and Rotterdam Italian restaurants might have it on the menu. But nothing, and, you know, maybe a listener will...
Not Arby's, for instance. We're not going to find it there.
Presumably not Arby's, okay. Or the McDonald's across the way.
All right. Well, very good. Hey, Roger, thanks a lot. Good luck with the quest.
Also, when you were talking about the way food is grown... have you ever had an experience with kosher chickens?
What kind of experience?
Well, yes. What kind of experience are you talking about? I have used.
Uh-oh.
I have used kosher chicken in the past. It really, to me, has a really higher quality flavor than a normal chicken.
Okay.
And it's because of the feeding and so on. But there's different levels of kosher. So.
Okay. Let's go to Tim in Albany. Tim, you're on.
Hi. I wonder if you guys have encountered, there's a cut of beef that I really enjoy. I used to eat it like easily once a week, and it's really tasty. It grills up pretty quickly, and here in this country we call it a hanger steak.
Yes.
And I think in French call it an anglais.
Yes.
But it's very tasty, mm-hmm. and you were talking about portion size before. It's not an overwhelming amount of beef.
Right.
And I am surprised that it hasn't caught on here in this area as much as it should.
Well, one place that does the hanger steak extremely well is the Garden Bistro up on Central Avenue, and now they have a place in Slingerland's, correct. And they do a really, really good job with that. And the reason it's so flavorful, it's actually is in part of the stomach cavity next to the liver. So it almost takes on that unctuous liver flavor to that piece of meat. And they also used to call it a butcher's tenderloin because the butcher would actually put that in his pocket and steal it and bring it home. Cook it for his family because it wasn't really a popular cut years and years ago, but it is a really, really great piece of
meat. Yeah, and it really grills pretty quickly, I believe.
Yes.
Because it's not like a big porterhouse thing that, and it's the right portion size. It's enough. You're satisfied, and it tastes great.
Yes, and you'll probably want to keep it at a medium rare, or no more than a medium, because it might have a tendency to get tough. But Garden Bistro 24 is absolutely the place to get hanger steak, and it's reasonably priced.
All right,
great.
Tim.
Thank you
very much for being here on our first ever Food Friday Vox Pop. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Steve Barnes is a columnist for the TU and a blogger, widely read blogger. Dale Miller, renowned chef here in the Capital Region, one of 68 certified master chefs in the entire U.S. You know, some time ago we had a French chef on, and it made a point of saying, you know, all the cuts of meat here are different in France, and they had to get a book to figure out how they could correspond. Is it really that different?
Absolutely. There's a lot of differences in the butchery of the animal in Europe and in America as well.
And it's just the way you cut, or parts that we don't use that they might use on the continent?
Parts that they might use. I mean, they'll use the lungs, you know, or the offal, they call it, you know, the kidneys, whatever, that wouldn't be popular here.
And it's also the butchery tradition. Yeah. If you cut a particular steak one way, you get one thing. And if you cut a section a different way, or through the bone a different way, you get another thing. And it's just cultural traditions. It's how it's evolved and the way they serve it.
That's Steve Barnes, also joined here by Dale Miller. I'm Ray Graff. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. And we get back to your calls in a moment.
Support for WAMC comes from the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York. Protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974, preservenys.org. Snow Farm Williamsburg, a New England craft program offering creative arts workshops taught by master craftspeople for adults and teens, beginners and up, snowfarm.org. And Orange County Tourism in the scenic Hudson Valley, offering farm-to-table events all winter long at wineries, winter farmers markets, restaurants, country inns, and more, orangetourism.org.
Thank you, Zach the Engineer. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 2:40 is the time, and we hit the home stretch now with Chef Dale Miller and Steve Barnes of the Times Union, and your calls at 800-348-2551. Terry and Skodak, you're next.
Hey, a couple of things. One, I just wanted to comment back with the gentleman who called in about celiac disease and gluten-free diets. It's not that it's on an increase per se of people having it, it's that we've become more aware of it and we're doing appropriate testing. Mm. 15 years ago, my then husband had every symptom of celiac disease you could think of, and none of the doctors knew what he had. So it's becoming more awareness of the disease. In Italy, it's so prevalent that children are tested for it before they even go to school.
Okay.
So I just wanted to make that comment. It's not that it's becoming increased, but we're just more aware of it. I do have a question while I was listening, though.
All right.
Any suggestions for a good restaurant that serves both vegetarian and carne options? I find I've adopted a vegetarian, ovo-lacto vegetarian diet. And I find when I go into restaurants, I quite often have a trace of macaroni and cheese or a salad drowning in dressing.
I bet Steve can answer this one.
Yes. The better restaurants out there have understand that, A, vegetables are amazing. And, you know, top chefs like Charlie Trotter and Thomas Keller have been offering 9 and 10 course tasting menus for 20 years. They understand that vegetables have amazing variety, much more interesting than proteins if you're willing to work with them. And so it isn't that the vegetarian options out there are not just a meat dish with some extra beans thrown in there and the meat taken out. They're actually conceived from the bottom of the plate up, from start to finish, as a vegetarian dish, and they're legitimately entrees meant for vegetarians. Some of the places that do them exceptionally well is Rick Orlando over at New World Bistro Bar and New World Home Cooking. Rick loves meat, but he also understands vegetables, and he will cater to vegetarians because they're a big, strong part of his crowd. And then he also down at Taste Restaurant, which used to be Dale Miller, The Art of Dining. They're very conscious of offering gluten-free as well as vegetarian dishes. And you know, any of your better restaurants in town that don't have the word steakhouse on the side will be able to make you a genuine dish that is not just some version of pasta primavera.
Okay.
Actually, I work right around the corner from Taste and have not had an opportunity to stop there, so that's a great suggestion. Thank
they also,
you.
Much of their menu is gluten-free as well, and is noted on the menu.
Terry, thank you.
Thank you. Have a great one.
Dale, you want to mention?
Yes, one other place that is one of my favorites is up in Clifton Park on Route 9 is Saigon Spring, and the tofu steak there is phenomenal. And they do have quite a few vegetarian dishes on their menu. And the flavors, it's Vietnamese cooking, and which is one of the top trends right now.
Let's talk about tofu for a minute. The challenges presented into making it taste like something.
Well, tofu is a blank canvas, so whatever flavor profiles you add to it is going to make it taste tremendous.
Is it difficult to work with from a chef standpoint?
I don't find it difficult to work with, and I really appreciate when people come in like Rick Orlando, I cater to vegetarians as well wherever I've worked, and I just love doing that because it's a challenge. I did a wedding for 150. It was a complete vegan wedding, and up at the Inn at Earl of West in Lake Georgia, mm-hmm. I was there, and it was really quite exciting.
Came out well?
Yes.
All right, this just in from the newsroom, handed to me by Brian Shields. Shrimp parm also available at the Italian Community Center in Albany. The restaurant being
Treviso.
Treviso, that's right.
The Malozzi family has Treviso, the restaurant, the Italian American Community Center.
So there you go. Let's go back to the phones. And Patricia in Schenectady, you're on.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for taking my phone call.
Thank you.
I have celiac disease, and I enjoy this program especially. However, I would like to ask a question if there are some. Well, I found one. Alcoholic beverage that has it's gluten-free. Do you suggest any other beverages that would that I could drink? You know, sometimes if I go out socially, I feel like I have my glass of water or a juice. That's about it.
Mm. Well, what sort of things do you like? Because something like a potato vodka or an apple vodka, core vodka is an apple based vodka. You know, those can certainly adapt. There are gluten free beers that are available.
Okay.
And so.
All right. I didn't know anything about the potato vodka. That's good.
And sake would also be a gluten-free.
All made out of rice, that's right.
Yes, correct, yes.
That's a good idea.
Yes.
And what about restaurants that would cater gluten-free without any gluten whatsoever in the area?
As I just mentioned to the previous caller, Taste Restaurant in downtown Albany is very aware of that and has been since it opened. Taste has everything denoted on the menu. And you'll also, any of the better restaurants, and by this I mean locally owned restaurants where you can talk to somebody who's the owner, they're aware of it. The gluten-free is such a growing trend. Being able to adapt to that, any restaurant worth what they're charging you can absolutely create a quality gluten-free meal for you. So it's important to speak up.
Patricia, thank you very much. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. First ever Food Friday, 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Chef Dale Miller is here and Steve Barnes of the Times Union. Let's go to Gene in Delmar. Hi, Gene, you're on.
Hi. I just want to add that one of the best hanger steaks in this area is at Tallulah in Glens Falls. It's very, very good there. But my
Tallulah
is
a wonderful restaurant.
Yeah. My question is, you know, when you go to a restaurant and some of our bigger chef owners are expanding, you know, how do you maintain consistency? Because we have been disappointed at some restaurants that I feel they've spread themselves too thin. So how does a chef maintain that consistency in multiple locations?
Dale.
Well, it would be within the staff that you hire and training that staff on your cooking style, and just constant monitoring and making sure that you know, and setting the standard for what you're looking for. Training is hugely important and finding qualified help that's going to carry on your philosophy and your vision for your food.
And
is that tough with the turnover?
Excuse me?
Good question.
Is that
tough
with high turnover?
It can be challenging, but I mean, if you do, if you cross train people on different stations, if somebody does leave the restaurant or the line, then somebody else can go in that spot. It used to be where people had certain stations where they just did saute, they just did the grill, they just did the garde manger part of it, and now we try to cross train people, our people on that.
How much tolerance do you have in the training process? In other words, some chefs, at least on the ones on TV, can be rather tough taskmasters. Do you have some patience and say, okay, well, you got to do this my way. Here's how you do it.
Well, I think some of that is done just for the media
theatrics effect.
You train somebody and you certainly will guide them. And I think it's just human nature that people start to like move away from what they've been doing a little bit and things start to change. So you have to just constantly pull them back.
Now, he sounds like a nice guy here, but I was covering a dinner. Dale was doing a very important dinner for a really prestigious group of people. 80 people, 80 of the most finicky diners around. And Dale said, if you're going to be in my kitchen, you're going to help. So I couldn't just sit there with a notepad.
Ah.
And what I was doing this tiny little canapé. They were going to walk past people on a tray, and they had these microgreens that I swear were maybe a quarter inch high with two little leaves on them.
Yeah.
And they all had to be facing the same way.
Ah.
Chef Dale went by and said, look at that. They're not all facing the same way. So hundreds of these little things all had to be facing the same way. And I went out and I watched. The average person spent less than 1 second between picking it up and putting it in their mouth. So when you've got that sort of professionalism, that sort of determination and perfectionism, it just infects the staff. And somebody who doesn't believe in that is going to leave.
Gene, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. It's Jeff in the Berkshires. Jeff, you're on.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, great. This is the first time I'm in the middle of moving.
Okay.
Came to the first, but I'm from the Cape Cod. But I got my culinary arts in Northampton, Western Mass.
All right.
And when you have people that work with you in your training, because that's what it is, usually the way I learned was we got dishwashers that were really working with and learning lessons. That's how the food came about. And you know, as far as customers come in, you treat them specially. You really treat them specially, and you're showing you what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, and you work with the customers, and then they come back tenfold and bring their friends back and do all that stuff. And then, as opposed to, like I said, the hollandaise, if you add a little bit of tomato paste, it's chardon.
Right.
If you make a, you know, basic hollandaise, leave out the tarragon and add that's a specific dish that they'll love. They'll come back.
All right,
it goes from there.
You got a question for us, Jeff?
Yeah.
Go.
So the variations of with the food that I was eating, the beef, because I'm up here in like Steventown, New York.
Okay.
And everything's the beef is getting really dropped. It's graze fed, and that's what people need to look for. To like, they need to actually put some time and effort into what they want when they go out and eat. So that they know, so that the chefs knows, then the patrons and the waiters know that they're special. Whenever you go to a restaurant, you make them special.
Well, I think that's one of the things that I've always done is the customer is gold. I mean, even in an employee chart. The owner isn't at the top of the list. The customer is at the top of the list, and then it goes down to the owner and an organizational chart. And so, treating the customer special and making them feel welcome and at home and special is what we do.
Do you ever get a little short-tempered with a boorish customer? Like if I went in, I don't know much. You know, give me a big steak, man, and a salad.
You can't, you know, unless they become, you know, like verbally or physically, you know.
Oh, I don't do
verbally
that.
Abusive to somebody. No, absolutely not.
Yeah, not anymore.
Because, as I said, that goes back to treating the customer like gold.
Right. It's one of the advantages of walk-in coolers and walk-in freezers. They have really thick doors. Mm-hmm. And so you can go in there, shut the door, scream your head off, and come back out and make a perfect dinner for the next person.
Fair enough. All right. Here's one from the, this is from our website, WAMC.org. Bill says, Ray, the certified master chef, American Culinary Federation, is the true rock star of food preparation. I'm thrilled you have Dale on the program. What a start for your show. Ask Dale to explain what a certified master chef is. It is far and above what we see on popular TV cooking shows.
Well, like I said, it's a certification sanctioned by the American Culinary Federation.
Yep.
Any chef can say that they're a master chef, but unless you said you're a certified master chef, you haven't gone through the 10-day test.
Okay.
And it is a 90% failure rate. That's why in 35 years of giving it, only about 78 or 80 have passed. Of course, some have passed away now, so there's 68 in the United States right now.
Did you really have to study for that?
Well, you have to have achieved certain goals through your career and getting gold medals for hot food and cold food competitions. You have to be recommended by 3 certified master chefs. So it's a lifelong, obviously, training. I always was afraid to go for it when one of the master chefs suggested that I try out for the test.
Yeah.
And he says, well, you'll know when you're ready. And so there was a point where I won a competition that was held locally, and I felt that was the time for me to go.
Do it. Absolutely. How was the essay portion?
Well, not too bad.
All right,
actually,
good.
Not too bad.
Dale Miller is our guest. Steve Barnes from the Times Union also. And back to the phones we go. James in Kingston, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I wanted to ask everyone, just in general, what was the best steak dish you've had and what was the cut?
Best steak.
I think the best steak I had was in Florence, Italy when I was there. It was... it's Chiana beef. It's a double thick porterhouse steak, and it's just done simply. It's called Fiorenza, steak Fiorenza, and it's just simply done. It's char grilled, and then it's napped with hot olive oil with garlic and lemon in it, and just some fresh parsley on it, and it was absolutely spectacular.
Rather than a specific steak, I wanted to recommend a specific preparation. There's a technique, because sometimes if you've got a steak, and you'll get these concentric rings of doneness from sort of gray done on the outside to, you know, pink and then red in the middle. You don't want that. There's a Cook's Illustrated magazine. You can find it on their website. But basically, you put the steak, nice thick steak, in the oven at low oven, like 175 degrees for about 40 minutes until the entire thing is about 100 degrees throughout, and then you blast it on a cast iron skillet. You get a perfect, all the way through, medium rare or rare, however you want it, with a nice crust. And that way, it takes a little bit longer, but this way you've got a perfect slice all the way through.
That is nice. James, thanks a lot. That's the way I like to grill. Very slowly at first, and then...
Blast it.
All right, let's see. Now, there's something I do know. Let's go to Megan, or is it Megan in Slingerlands?
Megan.
Hi, Megan, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's a great show.
Thanks.
Dale, I'd like to ask you a question.
Yes.
I have a recipe from a cookbook I bought in New Orleans after a 5-star dinner at Brennan's.
Yes.
I was presenting a paper, and I treated myself and some friends to dinner. And I've tried a recipe of Marchand de Vin, which is a beef done with a red wine.
Right.
But I really am puzzled as to what cut of beef that would really use that recipe well.
Is it similar? It's similar to like a beef bourguignon then?
Kind of, except there's not as much sauce.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of sauce.
I see.
To put over the steak.
And is the meat braised, or is it more of a quick pan sear?
No, it's braised.
It's braised.
And it sits in the oven for a couple hours or an hour and a half.
Well, I think anything like a chuck or a rump roast, where you could cut that into pieces, would I wonder if a
better cut of meat would taste even better. That's why I wanted to ask you.
Because you're braising it, it's not really necessary. I mean, if you were to use filet mignon, doesn't really have a lot of fat in it, so you need that marbling in there.
Right.
And believe it or not, even though you're braising in liquid, sometimes if it's not done correctly, it can be very dry.
Well, the times I've made it is delicious, and everybody loves it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered if you had ever made it yourself.
I have made something probably similar, but not that specific recipe.
It's got a lot of garlic in it.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so how could it not be good?
Right, that's right. Absolutely.
Megan, we're out of time. Thanks for calling.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Your blog address, Steve Barnes?
It's blog.timesunion.com/tablehopping, but easier is go to timesunion.com, and there's a link right there at the top of the page. Says click on table hopping, and it's updated every single day, and please comment.
And Dale Miller, how about you come and you cook something for the fun drive, which starts on February 3rd?
Sure, let me know. I am away that
aren't you
lucky? I'm
in
Puerto Rico, so.
Well done.
I would love to come, but.
You're off the hook, man.
Yeah, so.
That was a good excuse. Thanks, everybody, for being here and calling in. Sorry if you didn't make it through. Thanks to Zach, the engineer. And support comes from the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974. PreserveNYS.org. Snow Farm Williamsburg, a New England craft program offering creative arts workshops taught by master craftspeople for adults and teens, beginners and up. Snowfarm.org. And Orange County Tourism in the scenic Hudson Valley offering farm-to-table events all winter long at wineries, winter farmers markets, restaurants, country inns, and more. orangetourism.org. Well, not too bad start for the Food Friday. Thanks again to Steve Barnes and Chef Dale Miller for being here. Thanks to you for listening, and thanks to everyone involved with the program. Thanks to our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Next week starts off with Medical Monday and endocrinologist Dr. Matthew Looning. Stay tuned now for a news update.